Nathan had promised before leaving Kansas City to meet with Foster Hagerman of the AT&SF and with Sheriff Harrington, who traveled in from Dodge.
So now that the Indian problem is about to be resolved, there are more and more settlers wishing to travel to North Texas and eastern New Mexico. There is no railroad any closer than Dodge City, and there's an increasing demand for men to guide immigrants from Dodge to point south. Pay would depend on the distance and the number of wagons. From Dodge to Fort Griffin, Texas, you could earn as much as $300.
I'm bound for the diggings in Dakota Territory. There, it's possible I could earn $300 in one day, or maybe an hour.
It's also possible you could go broke, keeping yourself in grub, and end up without a peso. It'll cost you more than $10 a day just to eat. And in two more months, there'll be blizzards howling in from the Rockies. The strike in the Black Hills isn't even 3 months old, and there's not a hotel or boarding house any closer than Cheyenne.
My God, I've never seen you so fired up. Are you expecting that much business from immigrants?
He hasn't quite told you all of it. There's talk of a twice-a-week stage line from Dodge into Texas. And if it comes to pass, that'll add considerably to the amount of mail the AT&SF is able to deliver. While there's not a whole lot in between, there's a hell of a lot of soldiers and civilians at Fort Griffin, while Fort Worth's not that far away. Just delivering government mail to those two outposts could buy Hagerman two or three new locomotives. Just looking at him, can't you tell he's hungry?
He does look a mite lank. Now, I reckon these immigrants will be buying the wagons, mules, and oxen in Dodge. Have you managed to get your hands on the wagon yard and the livery?
No, I'll have to be satisfied with emigrant fares to Dodge, and if a stage line comes to pass, the increased mail delivery.
Aside from Hagerman needing the money, you might want to take this on for a while, till they take some of the rough edges off that gold camp. If you went there in the spring, say, next April, there might be some hotels and boarding houses to shelter you from the blizzards.
Better yet, you'd have the whole summer to strike it rich and get out of there before the blizzards come.
Damn it, you varmints just won't let a man have any peace. Suppose I agree to this pilgrim caravan. When do I start?
As soon as you can get back to Dodge. Your first run is to Fort Griffin, and there'll be three wagons.
Hell, I thought you were here because you were concerned that I might be strung up, when all you wanted was to get me back in harness, making money for you.
Well, he was concerned you might be strung up. Then he wouldn't have anybody to lead those wagons to Fort Griffin.
I will be grateful if you'll help me get this off the ground. Washington assures me the problem with the Plains Indians has been resolved. Quanah Parker and the last of the Comanches surrendered 3 months ago.
Then all I'll have to bother with are the outlaws from Indian Territory.
And they shouldn't be that much of a problem. Once a stage line has been established, there may be some valuable shipments, but immigrant wagons shouldn't be much of a temptation.
It sounds safe enough, but if there are no Indians and no outlaws, why do you need me?
Because I can't promise you there'll be no outlaws, and because we are dealing with Easterners who fear for their lives.
And you think one man's going to convince them they're safe?
Not just any one man. Nathan Stone. Even in the East, you have a reputation.
You're 9 feet tall. You bite rattlers to watch them die. You're so tough you wear out your britches from the inside. At the very sight of you, grown men cringe in the latest swoon.
My God, I have enough problems without such foolishness as that being spread around. I have some damn fool testing me with a gun every day.
I haven't gone quite that far, but it will be a comfort to people who are new to the frontier, knowing there's a man of your experience guiding them.
I'm to be a guide then?
Yes. In case of outlaws, you would dispose of them, of course.
Of course.
I can count on you then?
Until spring. Then, despite expensive grub, blizzards, and a total lack of hotels, I'm riding to Dakota Territory.
I've arranged a boxcar for your horse. We leave in 1 hour.
Dodge City, Kansas, September 2nd, 1875. Nathan again had a room at the Dodge House, courtesy of the AT&SF. Hagerman had arranged for him to meet the emigrants in Delmonico's dining room. When he arrived, there was Foster Hagerman and 11 emigrants. Hagerman performed the introductions.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your guide, Nathan Stone. And starting at my left, this is Owen and Emma Kilgore. The Reverend Kilgore is bound for Fort Griffin. Next, there's Tally Dismuke and his sons, Gabe, Cyrus, Lawn, and Ellis. And they're going to Fort Griffin. Finally, bound from Obeetee, there's the ladies, Mamie, Cora, Winnie, and Eula.
Nathan nodded. The Kilgores sat there stern and unsmiling, as though their faces might crack like a looking glass and tinkle to the floor. On the other hand, the Dismukes all wore overalls, brogan shoes, and wide grins. Tally Dismuke looked about two-thirds drunk, and the sons at varying stages in between. The four women were all dressed in revealing clothes and looked as though they might have recently departed one of the many whorehouses in Kansas City or St. Louis.
Now, you will be leaving the wagon yard in the morning at dawn. If you have questions, I'm sure Mr. Stone will be glad to answer them.
Yeah. Is them guns for show, or can you use them for real?
I can use them when I have to, but sometimes a good spanking is all it takes.
The Dismukes slapped their thighs and stomped their feet, drawing venomous looks from the Reverend Owen Kilgore. The four questionable women cast covert glances at Nathan and giggled among themselves.
If there are no more questions, all of you are free to prepare for an early start in the morning.
Damn, where'd you come up with them?
Well, the three groups are paying $100 each for your company from here to Texas. It should be an interesting experience.
I reckon before I get there, compared to this bunch, the Indians and outlaws won't seem so bad.
When Nathan arrived at the wagon yard, empty shied away from the strangers. Much to Nathan's surprise, the wagons were to be drawn by mules instead of oxen. Mules had to have grain, and Nathan quickly learned that none of his charges had provided any. The women were the most aggravating.
Well, now, that just don't make no sense at all. Back in Kentucky, the critters lived on grass.
Ma'am, those mules won't pull that wagon from here to Texas without grain. Until there's 100 pounds of grain in that wagon, I'm not taking it out of this wagon yard.
We can't afford no grain, unless we can come back on our grub.
Or the whiskey. This damn wagon won't be going anywhere until you buy some grain for the mules.
Nathan tied the reins of the Gruya to a hitch rail and sat down on the edge of a water trough. Empty sidled over and sat down beside him, his eyes on the strangers with the wagons. The Reverend Kilgore was the first to comply with Nathan's request, rearranging the contents of the wagon to make room for the sack of grain. The four women, to the horror of the Kilgores, hoisted their skirts and began removing money from their secret places, while the Dismukes clan looked on in open admiration. Finally, when the show was over, Tally Dismuke arranged for the necessary sacks of grain.
Prepare to move out!
Nathan rode out, empty, trotting beside him. He looked back and the wagons had fallen in behind him, the Kilgore wagon in the lead. At least they seemed capable enough to handle their teams and the wagons. They traveled a distance of 15 miles, stopping occasionally to rest the teams. Despite the fact they were all traveling together, there were three separate camps, and Nathan felt welcome in none of them. They were near a creek, and Nathan had picketed the Gruya well away from the mules. Starting a small fire, he made supper for himself and Empty. The others built larger fires, and Nathan was thankful the Indian threat had been resolved. After supper, he went near enough to the wagons for everybody to hear what he had to say.
We'll be moving out at first light. Anybody have a mind to have breakfast, you best roll out early enough to be done with it.
Did he say be done with it or be done with her?
The Kilgores put out their fire and turned in early, but there was no evidence any of the others intended to follow their example. The laughter and shouting at the Dismuke's fire grew louder. It hadn't taken long for the four females to make friends with the Dismukes, and Nathan hadn't even removed his hat before something was wrong. When Nathan reached the Dismuke's wagon, Ellis was straddling a virtually naked Mamie who was flat on her back.
Get off her and get up.
No, by God! She drinks my whiskey, she does what I say.
Nathan drew his Colt. Oh! The lobe of Ellis's left ear disappeared in a spray of blood.
The bastard shot me!
The next time I shoot you, you won't be getting up. Mamie, you get up, get back to your wagon, and stay there. Cora, Winnie, and Eula, go with her. Now.
The four women hastened to obey, Mamie grabbing the rag that had been her dress, trying to cover herself. The five Dismukes stared sullenly at Nathan, Ellis holding a bandana to his bleeding ear.
Damn you, we ain't paying you for this kind of treatment.
You're paying me to get you to Fort Griffin. While you're with me, you travel under my rules, not yours. Next one of you I find hunkered over one of those women, I'll kill you. This is all the warning you're gonna get.
Hell, they ain't nothing but whores! And they drunk our whiskey!
I'm not interested in your opinions. It's all I can do to stand you, varmints, cold sober. I think we'll get along better without the whiskey.
Nathan cast his eye toward 3-quart bottles of whiskey that stood on the wagon's lowered tailgate.
Damn you. Damn you, give us back our money. We ain't going nowhere with you.
Oh, but you are. I agreed to see you safely to Fort Griffin, and by God, I keep my promises. If I have to, I'll hogtie the whole damn lot of you, chunk you in the wagon, and drive it myself.
It's a ways yet, and you gotta sleep sometime. We'll get you.
I'm a light sleeper, and when you come after me, wear your burying clothes, because you'll be needing them.
He backed out of the circle of light cast by the dying fire and returned to his blankets. Empty was there, and he was thankful for the faithful dog's presence. There was no way anybody could approach him without a warning from Empty. He removed his gun belt, but kept one of the Colts in his hand. The second day out of Dodge, they crossed the Cimarron River, spending the night at the very edge of Indian Territory's panhandle. 3 more days, Nathan thought, and they would reach Mobiti, where he would be rid of the 4 women. That would solve half his problem, for the Kilgores had avoided him. Once out of Mobiti, he estimated it would be maybe 150 miles north to Fort Griffin. 2 more weeks of Kilgore silence and Dismuke hate. Mobiti, Texas, September 8, 1875. Mobiti had begun with a trading post catering to buffalo hunters, but the buffalo were gone. All that had saved Mobiti from total obscurity was the establishment of Fort Elliott, 1/2 mile south of Sweetwater Creek and about 1 mile from Mobiti. Mobiti consisted of the trading post, a saloon, and 3 slab-sided shanties. Of all the buildings, the saloon was the most impressive, and it was there that the 4 women reined up their teams.
I reckon this is Mobiti. Mamie, Cora, Winnie, and Eula, this is as far as you go. The rest of you are about 150 miles north of Fort Griffin. We'll be staying the night at Fort Elliott, 1 mile or so from here.
Fort Elliott was a new outpost and seemed to justify the determination of the women who had relocated to Mobiti. The buildings were long, rambling structures built in a rectangle, in the center of which was the parade ground. There was a sentry on duty before the fort's offices. Nathan rode ahead of the wagons and reined up.
I'm Nathan Stone, guiding some folks south to Fort Griffin. We aim to stay the night somewhere along the creek. I reckon I'll say howdy to your post commander if he'll see me.
Nathan entered the office and the captain stepped around the desk to shake his hand. Briefly, Nathan told him of the eventual plan to establish a twice-a-week stage run between Dodge City and Fort Griffin.
God knows we'll welcome it. As things now stand, the best we can expect is a once-a-month supply train from Fort Dodge. When do the stages begin?
Well, I don't know, but probably sometime between now and spring. Right now, I'm working with the railroad, filling in the gap by guiding people from Dodge City into Texas. Well, I just left 4 women at the saloon in Mobiti.
Thanks. Given a choice, I'd consider swapping that saloon for Quanah Parker and the Comanches.
I reckon. Add women to the whiskey and gambling, and you have all the necessary elements to send a man straight to hell.
Or to the guardhouse. We're at full strength with close to 500 men, and on any given Monday morning, there's maybe 20% of them in the stockade, charged with drunk and disorderly conduct.
I can see where you'd likely stand a better chance with the engines. I just wanted to tell you why we're here, and to get permission to spend the night along the creek.
Permission granted. You and your emigrants are welcome to take your meals at the enlisted men's mess this evening and in the morning.
That's generous of you, Captain. I accept, and I'll mention it to the others.
Nathan rode back to the wagons.
We'll take the wagons over yonder beyond those buildings at the far side of the post and make our camp along the creek. Captain Selman has invited us to take supper tonight and breakfast in the morning with the enlisted men. Now, I aim to be there, and I expect all of you to be on your best behavior. If there's trouble involving any of you, I'll have the captain lock you in the stockade and leave you there until you moss over.
We ain't eating with no blue bellies. We're going back to Mobiti, to the saloon. That is, unless you're of a mind to try and stop us.
I won't stop you, but I am going to warn you. Don't get involved in anything so deep you can't get out. If you aim to rear up on your hind legs like a man, Be prepared to take whatever comes with the territory.
The five Dismukes glared at him defiantly. Nathan rode onto the creek beyond the post, where he unsaddled, and after the Gruya had time to roll, he rubbed the animal down. From the sack he carried behind his saddle, he fed the horse a ration of grain and turned it loose to graze. Then he rested, using his saddle for a pillow. The Kilgores followed and made their camp well beyond his. Nathan watched approvingly as Kilgore unharnessed his team, allowed the mules to roll, and then rubbed them down. On the frontier, a man who failed to tend his horse or mule was a fool. The Dismukes didn't show, and Nathan decided they'd made good their bid to visit the saloon in Mobiti. He fully expected the lot of them to be roaring drunk when he saw them again. He dozed until the fort's bugler blew mess call. Empty followed him to the enlisted men's mess hall, lagging behind. Nathan waited until the soldiers had all been served before approaching one of the cooks on the serving line. The soldiers were friendly, and he saw nothing wrong with telling them of the proposed stage run from Dodge City south to Fort Griffin. He spent a pleasant hour there before going back to his place beside the creek, where his horse grazed. Several hundred yards away, cook fires were going before the Indians' teepees. The Kilgores had already prepared their supper, and their fire had died down to coals. Suddenly, Ellis Dismuke rode in astride one of the mules. Blood dripped from his nose and mouth. His shirt had been torn off, and his upper body was a mass of bleeding cuts. He fell off the mule, and it was a moment before he could speak.
Them soldiers jumped us. They done killed long, and they're beating hell out of the others.
Despite his vow not to become involved, Nathan couldn't afford to ignore the fight since it involved the soldiers. The Dismukes might sour the military on other emigrants, making them unwelcome at the forts, and Nathan Stone along with them. Quickly, Nathan saddled the Gruya and set out for the saloon in Mobiti. He arrived in time to see Tally Dismuke emerge headfirst through a window. Nathan hit the ground running. When he entered the saloon, he was showered with glass from a thrown bottle. Lon Dismuke lay on his back in a pool of blood, his throat slashed. The two remaining Dismukes were behind an upended table, while a dozen soldiers were advancing, some of them with knives in their hands. Nathan drew his Colt.
That's enough!
Step aside.
Six armed soldiers entered the saloon. Quickly, they disarmed their knife-wielding companions and backed them up against the wall. One of the military policemen pointed the muzzle of his rifle at the blood-soaked Dismukes and addressed himself to Nathan.
Mister, do you know these men?
I'm afraid I do. They're on their way to Fort Griffin, and we stopped here for the night. I have no idea how this started. I came to break it up because just this evening I met with Captain Selman, and I want no trouble with the military.
That soldier cut the man on the floor after the hombre come after him with a broken bottle.
You Dismukes heard the charge. What do you have to say?
He cut long without no cause.
Tally Dismuke pushed his way back into the saloon, limping, bleeding from numerous cuts.
They're right. The dead man wanted one of the women, but she was with one of the soldiers. They fought over her, and he lost.
Will that satisfy you soldiers, if we call the killing justified?
We're obliged.
Hell no, we ain't calling it justified. We ain't leaving here till we get that bastard to killed long.
That's the way you want it. I'm not involved in this. I'll let these men from the post put you in the stockade, and the post commander can decide what to do with you. I aim to tell them that this entire affair appears to have been your fault, and I'm washing my hands of the lot of you.
One of the soldiers had Tally covered with a rifle, while two others hustled Ellis and Gabe to their feet.
But damn it, we're civilians. You can't lock us up.
Wrong, mister. There's no law here except martial law, and that's us. Move.
Soldier, there was another one of them varmints. He run off.
He's there beside the creek, where they all should have been.
Stone, you Judas bastard! We'll get you for this!
Less than an hour later, Nathan entered the post commander's office and found the captain behind his desk, his face grim.
Stone, I realize this isn't your doing, but I'm going to ask you to help in resolving it. Like I told you, I have trouble enough keeping the men who are garrisoned here from killing one another without civilian help from elsewhere. I'm going to turn this bunch loose in the morning on two conditions. One, I want them out of here at first light. And if they return, They're subject to being shot. Two, I have prepared a letter to the post commander at Fort Griffin, which you are to deliver. He is being warned of this incident here, and I am suggesting that these men, the Dismukes, be barred from the post in general and the sutler's store in particular. God forbid that they should get their hands on any more whiskey. Does my decision meet with your approval?
It does, sir. I'll do my best to rid you of them and take your warning to the post commander at Fort Griffin.
Thank you. Consider yourself welcome here anytime.
Nathan said nothing to the Dismukes about the letter he carried to the post commander at Fort Griffin. He would wait until he reached the fort before informing the troublesome clan they weren't welcome. After Captain Selman had them released from the guardhouse, Nathan allowed the surviving Dismukes time to bury Lon. Finally, they returned to their waiting wagon and clambered aboard, Tally taking the reins. Nathan led out, riding south. Thanks to the Dismukes, their departure was 2 hours late, and that day, Nathan estimated they had traveled not more than 10 miles. The third day after leaving Fort Elliott, Nathan's uneasy alliance with the Dismukes blew up.
We ain't following you no further. Go on without us.
I might remind you that you're no longer welcome at Fort Elliott, and I'm delivering a letter to the post commander at Fort Griffin barring you from that post.
I ain't surprised. We owe you a powerful lot, Stone. Now you just keep going, and we'll do as we damn well please.
Nathan rode out. They were grown men, and despite his threats, he couldn't see it as his responsibility to force them to follow him to Fort Griffin, especially since they, as a result of Captain Selman's warning, would be barred from the post. He looked back once, and only the Kilgore wagon was following him.
Ha! I ain't wanting to be locked in that guardhouse no more. There ain't nothing we can do for long. Why can't we just go on to Fort Griffin?
You heard what Stone said. We're still 100 miles from the damn place, and already we've been barred. Besides, we ain't done with them bluebellies back yonder at Fort Elliott.
There must be near 500 soldiers. We ain't got a chance.
Not in a fair fight, maybe. But us Dismukes ain't bound to fight fair. We still got that case of dynamite in the wagon. We'll circle that soldier fort in the dark, and with some short fuses, we'll blow the place to hell and gone.
Oh, I like it, Pa. That'll show them they can't push us Dismukes around.
We owe that bunch at the Mobiti Saloon a thing or two. Maybe we'll mosey by there and empty their cash drawer.
Two hours before sundown, Nathan reined up, waiting for the Kilgore wagon to reach him.
Next water we come to, we'll make camp. I'm riding back to Fort Elliott to warn the post that the Dismukes are likely returning. I'll rejoin you as soon as I can.
But that's unfair to us. You agreed to lead us to Fort Griffin, and that means without delay.
Wrong. I promised to guide you to Fort Griffin, but the time involved is up to me. This is the frontier, and a man is guided by circumstances, not time. There is a chance that men will die unless I warn Captain Selman at Fort Elliott. It's not quite 50 miles, and I should be back here by dawn. Put out your fire before dark and keep to your wagon. I'll see you in the morning.
Nathan rode northeast, not wishing to catch up to the Dismukes. Empty ran on ahead, dropping back once. Once certain that he was ahead of the Dismuke wagon, Nathan resumed a northerly direction. He spared the Gruya, resting the horse often. The Dismukes, if they pushed their teams, wouldn't cover more than 20 miles before being forced to halt for the night and to feed the mules. Facing himself, resting his horse often, Nathan reached Fort Elliott well before midnight. He had the sergeant of the guard awaken the captain. Having had experience with the Dismukes, Selman wasn't likely to take the threat lightly.
Sorry to awaken you, Captain, but the Dismukes refuse to continue on to Fort Griffin. They're evidently on their way back here, and I have no idea what kind of arms they may have inside their wagon. You should double your guard at least. And while I realize the saloon in Mobiti isn't your responsibility, it's a source of whiskey that I don't think the Dismukes will overlook. You should send some men there in the morning and keep them there until you resolve this.
I respect your observations and the warning. Whatever they're planning to do, we'll be prepared. Will you stay the night?
No, I left the Kilgores more than 40 miles south of here, and I promise to return there by dawn. I'll stay the night with you on my way back to Dodge.
You do that, and I'll fill you in on what happens here.
Nathan rode southeast, wary lest he stumble on the Dismuke sleeping camp. But he had nothing to fear, for Empty was always out there ahead of him. When Nathan estimated he had ridden 30 miles, he changed direction, riding due south. He had no trouble finding the Kilgore wagon, for its canvas had been silvered by a descending moon. After unsaddling and allowing the Gruya to roll, Nathan rubbed him down, then picketed the horse near the mules. He spread his blankets near the creek to sleep for what remained of the night. Empty lay down beside him. He would always miss Cotton Blossom, but there was much comfort in knowing the valiant hound had left behind a son who was rapidly walking in his sire's footsteps. The next morning, both Nathan and the Kilgores rose at dawn. He wanted only to deliver the surly, silent Kilgores to Fort Griffin and be rid of them. Nathan led out, riding south, Empty running ahead. The Kilgore wagon followed, and Nathan stepped up the pace. When they reached Fort Griffin, 5 days later, Nathan was shown into the office of Fort Griffin's post commander, who had received a telegram from Captain Selman.
Disregard letter Nathan Stone carries. Stop. Dismukes all dead. Stop. Captain Selman, Fort Elliott.
Nathan spent only one night at Fort Griffin. He was determined to have some better understanding with Foster Hagerman before guiding any more emigrants south. While he was perfectly capable of keeping his charges in line, he felt like a schoolmarm. Spring was a hell of a long ways off. One more bunch of rot-gut-drinking, hell-raising misfits like the Dismukes, and he'd drop the whole deal right back in Foster Hagerman's lap. Fort Elliott, Texas, September 20th, 1875.
We're considerably in your debt. Two nights after you warned us, the Dismukes showed up. They had a case of dynamite with short fuses, and they came at us from four directions. If we hadn't been expecting them, then God knows how much damage they might have done. They were like madmen, refusing to surrender, and we had to shoot them down. Enter.
Sir, it's Sergeant King again. He started a brawl over a woman last night, and one of the barkeeps in the Mobidi Saloon laid him out cold with a bung starter.
He's alive, I suppose?
Yes, sir. But he may have a concussion. He's being examined at the dispensary now. What do you want done with him?
Fine him a month's pay and lock him in the guardhouse for 10 days.
I reckon the women I brought down from Dodge are causing their share of trouble.
Yes, but we can hardly blame that on you. If men don't have women, they'll fight over something else. I busted sergeants back to corporals and corporals back to privates, but there's so little difference in the pay, nobody gives a damn.
Captain, thank you for your hospitality. We'll likely be seeing you again in a few days.
Nathan left Texas and entered Indian territory. About to cross the North Canadian River, he reined up and dismounted. The Gruya wanted water, but he restrained it until the animal had rested. It was then that he saw the buzzard circling a few miles up ahead. Somebody was dead, or soon about to be. Nathan mounted and rode on across the North Canadian, bound for the Cimarron. Well before he reached the river, Empty circled back to meet him, evidence enough that something was wrong. Nathan eased the Gruya down to a walk, hooking his right thumb in his gun belt near the butt of his colt. He saw the dead horse first, and the animal still wore a saddle. The horse had been shot through the head. There in a shallow arroyo, a man lay on his back. He'd been gut shot, for blood soaked the shirt where it covered his belly. Above the left breast pocket of the shirt was pinned a lawman's badge. The holster on his right hip was empty. The lawman's hat was missing, and his receding hair was gray. When Nathan knelt beside him with the canteen, the wounded man's eyes fluttered open.
I'll do what I can for you, partner.
Ain't much. I'm gut shot.
It was true. Without question, he was a dead man, the only uncertainty being how long he might suffer before death mercifully took him.
Best if you don't talk. I'll get some blankets.
No. No time. Need to talk.
Then tell me who you are and what happened. Maybe I can catch up to the varmint that shot you.
Franklin Monroe, sheriff of Santa Fe. My kid brother.
What about your brother?
Virgil. Shot me.
Why?
He robbed a bank. I came after him. Promised our ma I'd take care of him. He's a wild one. I caught up to him. Got the drop. Swore he'd go back with me. Take his punishment. Caught me off guard. Shot me.
As the dying man coughed, blood came out. Nathan tried to give him more water, but he was unable to take it. Monroe had strangled on his own blood. Nathan removed his hat and stood there a moment. He had no tools, no means of burying the man, but he couldn't leave him to the coyotes and the relentless circling buzzards. He took one of his blankets and covered the corpse. The shallow arroyo would have to do, and the only available cover was stones. Nathan started gathering them, as large as he could carry, and it took him a good 3 hours to cover the dead man to the extent that predators couldn't get at him. Only when he had finished did he realize he had failed to search the man's body, and he wasn't about to remove all the stones. He knew the man's name and the name of the brother who had done the killing, and that it had been the result of a bank robbery in Santa Fe. Killing a man over stolen money was bad enough, but it seemed especially heinous when that man was one's own brother. Nathan circled the area until he picked up the tracks of the killer's horse, and not surprisingly, they led north. It was entirely possible that Virgil Monroe was on his way to Dodge City. There, Nathan could tell his story to Sheriff Harrington, who might be able to arrest the killer and recover the stolen money. Nathan's sympathy was with the dead lawman, and if the murdering kid brother got the rope, it would be no more than he deserved. Dodge City, Kansas, September 21st, 1875. Nathan and Harrington entered the Dodge house after checking the liveries to see if any strangers had come into town today.
After the hotels, we can try the boarding houses, but I doubt this gent will sign in under his own name.
I'll stick with you. After that bunch of immigrants I already took south, I'm in no hurry to get back to Hagerman for more.
They approached the front desk.
Howdy, Sheriff.
Wiggins, we need to take a look at your register.
I don't want no trouble here, Sheriff.
Wiggins, if the hombre we're looking for is here, he is trouble. Has anybody signed in this morning?
One. We don't get many until the evening train.
Yeah, let me see that register.
The scrawled signature read, Franklin Monroe.
And no account varmint signed his dead brother's name. Is he here?
No.
I need a key to his room, unless you're going to insist on seeing a search warrant.
Well, nah, I suppose not.
When Nathan and Sheriff Harrington reached the room, they carefully stood on each side of the door in case they were met with gunfire. There was no response from within, and Harrington reached around and tried the key. The bed hadn't been disturbed. Lying across it were saddlebags and a Winchester. Swiftly, Harrington unbuckled the flaps of the saddlebags. In one side, there was a clean shirt, 2 pairs of socks, and an extra tin of shells. The other side yielded only a strip of paper, but printed on it were the words, Bank of Santa Fe.
If a dying man's word means anything, we're justified in tracking down this varmint.
We about eliminated everything except the saloons. This gent, with money in his pocket, he'd be looking for a place to spend it. That usually leads to a poker table or a whorehouse. And at this time of day, I'd consider a poker table the most likely.
They tried the long branch and found no game in progress, but their luck improved when they reached the oasis. A four-handed game was underway, and while Nathan knew few of the residents of Dodge, he detected a slight reaction from one of the men when he saw Harrington's badge. He sat with his back to the wall and dropped his hand below the table. The move wasn't lost on the sheriff.
Take your hand away from your gun and stand up, Monroe.
I never seen you before in my life, and you ain't got nothing on me.
Sensing trouble, his three companions slid back their chairs and got out of the way.
Now unbuckle your gun belt and let it fall to the floor.
Nah, you got nothing on me.
We have the words of a dying man, and he accused you, Virgil Monroe, of shooting him.
I ain't told you my name.
You don't have to. Your actions spoke for you. Now unbuckle the gun belt, and we'll mosey on over to the jail. That coat you're wearing looks a mite heavy in places, and I'm wondering why.
Slowly, Monroe unbuckled the gun belt and allowed it to fall to the floor. The sheriff had not drawn his gun, and Monroe moved just enough to place Harrington between himself and Nathan. Only Monroe's right arm moved as he palmed the sleeve gun. Nathan saw it coming, but for just a crucial second, Sheriff Harrington was between him and Monroe. Harrington stumbled, slumping to the floor. Nathan drew his Colt and shot Monroe just as the killer squeezed off a second shot from the Derringer. The lead burned a raw furrow along Nathan's left arm above the elbow. The barkeep and the three men who had been gambling with Monroe had gathered around. Nathan knelt beside the dying sheriff, leaning close in case Harrington had any last words. But Harrington's eyes lost their focus, and he was gone. With a lump in his throat, Nathan got to his feet. The shots had drawn men from Delmonico's across the street. One of the new arrivals was Foster Hagerman. He stared, unbelieving, at the dead man who had long been his friend.
My God, what happened? Why?
With some difficulty, Nathan explained. Others who had gathered around turned their hostile eyes on Nathan, and finally one of them said what the rest were thinking.
Damn you! Our sheriff was gunned down over something you dragged in! Something that wasn't no concern of his!
He believed it was. You'll find the man who shot him has all or most of the money stolen from the Bank of Santa Fe. He's also guilty of having shot a lawman from Santa Fe who's pursuing him.
Well, there'll have to be a sheriff appointed. Brady, go fetch the acting mayor.
Damn shame the sheriff had no deputy.
I agree. He'd been asking for one, but the town council's too damn cheap to pay a man. Oh, this comes at a bad time. Mayor Wright died last Sunday. The acting mayor was Rufus Langley, and he had to be drafted.
Nathan wasn't impressed with acting Mayor Langley. He wore the white apron of a storekeeper and the manner of a man who clearly wished he were somewhere else. Hatless, dressed in town clothes, he appeared to be in his 50s. He looked around, obviously uncertain as to what was expected of him.
Rufus, since the town council saw fit not to hire a deputy, you're going to have to appoint a sheriff until an election can be held.
Well, what about you?
Well, don't be a damn fool. I work for the railroad.
The man who killed Sheriff Harrington should be searched. He should be carrying all or most of the money stolen from the Bank of Santa Fe.
All we got on that is your word.
Search him yourself.
Go ahead. You're more qualified than the rest of us.
Only if you count the money and Mr. Langley takes charge of it on behalf of the town. It should be returned to Santa Fe.
Search the man. If he's a thief and the money's there, I'll see that it's returned to the bank from which it was stolen.
Nathan removed the bulky coat from the dead man, discovering the lining had been ripped and crudely re-sewn. He ripped the lining loose and shook out the bundles of bills, each packet bearing a Bank of Santa Fe identifying band. Nathan made no move toward the stolen money, allowing Langley to gather it up and place it on a table. Men crowded close.
Stand back, all of you.
Langley removed his store apron and used it to bundle up the packets of bills.
I don't know that I trust him with all that.
I want nothing to do with it. It's my fault Sheriff Harrington's dead. I brought him face to face with the thief and killer. It wasn't his responsibility to make that arrest.
He didn't think of it as a responsibility. As a lawman, he saw it as a duty. The same duty that drove you into a near-fatal fight with Chapa Gonzalez and his band of outlaws. You think like a lawman, and someday in some town on the frontier, you'll die with your boots on, going against impossible odds for what you believe is right.
I considered him one of my friends, but I never knew his first name.
Few people did. If your name was Percival, would you be using it?
No. And I'd leave a will, begging them that done the burying not to chisel it into the stone.
There'll be a stone. I'll see to that. Do you want to go ahead and get your room at the Dodge House, or do you want to go back to my office and talk? There'll be time for the funeral later this afternoon, and if I'm not busy, I'll hole up somewhere and dread that.
So will I. So let's talk. I want to tell you about the Dismukes.
Oh, I've heard enough about them. 3 days after you took the trail south, I learned they were wanted by the law in Missouri.
They're out of reach of the law. They let their hell-raising get ahead of their better judgment.
He then told Hagerman what had become of the troublesome Dismukes clan.
Well, I don't know when there'll be another bunch going south. Maybe not until after Christmas.
Then I can't promise you I'll hang around until then. I'll be where you can reach me, and I'll see it through until spring, but no longer.
Sheriff Harrington's funeral was well attended. and it was evident the lawman would be missed. It was a dreary, lonesome time. Death had won another hand. The morning after Sheriff Harrington's funeral, Nathan was just finishing breakfast at Delmonico's when Foster Hagerman came in. Without waiting for an invitation, he hooked a chair with his boot and sat down at Nathan's table.
Won't you join me?
Thanks. I have a proposition for you, and I wanted to catch you in a good mood.
I'm not in a good mood.
Then before your bad mood gets any worse. Since you're at loose ends for a while, I want you to take the sheriff's badge.
No.
Just temporarily until we can find someone else. Do it for the town.
Why should I? All this town's ever done for me is accuse me of getting its sheriff killed.
Then, by God, do it for me. I've influenced the AT&SF to spend a bundle touting the safety of the railroad and the railroad towns, inviting people to come west. If Dodge is allowed to backslide into a lawless cattle town, I'm going to come off looking like a damn fool.
Hagerman, you're always out on some kind of limb. One day I aim to back off and see just how big a fool you can make of yourself. So much natural talent just shouldn't go to waste.
Then you'll do it?
On a temporary basis. Like I told you, I'm riding to Dakota Territory in the spring, even if you have to board up Dodge and shut down the railroad. Now, where do I go to be sworn in?
Over to the Mercantile. I told Langley you'd be there right after breakfast.
Only when Hagerman realized what he had said did he seem a trifle embarrassed, and he didn't miss the hard look in Nathan's eyes. Here was a man it didn't pay to take for granted, and Foster Hagerman knew he was near to stepping over the line.
The AT&SF will continue to pay for your room and meals.
Nathan nodded and stood. He didn't like Rufus Langley, and he wanted to be sworn in and done with the man. It was still early morning, and the Mercantile was deserted. Langley seemed ill at ease as he stumbled through the swearing-in, even though he had the procedure written down. When the formalities were over, he moved to the practical considerations.
Do you understand your duties?
Probably better than you. Have you done anything toward returning the money taken from the Bank of Santa Fe?
No, I took possession of it late yesterday, and it's not even 8 o'clock in the morning.
Get it. I'll see that it's returned, along with a report on Virgil Monroe and of his killing of Santa Fe Sheriff Monroe.
Langley had transferred the bundles of bills to an enormous sack, and he surrendered it without a word. Nathan couldn't help wondering if the sack contained all the money he had taken off Virgil Monroe's body. Pinning the sheriff's badge on his shirt, Nathan put the office key in his pocket, took the sack of stolen money, and left the store. He composed a telegram to the Bank of Santa Fe and took it and the stolen money to the depot, to Foster Hagerman's office.
It's open.
This I want you to lock in your safe until I'm told what to do with it. Now here's the telegram I want sent to the Bank of Santa Fe.
After leaving Hagerman's office, Nathan walked around town. They might as well get used to seeing him wearing the badge. Time dragged, and at noon, Nathan went to Delmonico's to eat. He wasn't all that hungry, there just was nothing better to do. When he heard the distant whistle of the westbound, he went to the depot to watch the train come in. He recalled the many times Sheriff Harrington had done this very thing, and now he understood the old sheriff's reason. Two men got off of the train, and Nathan sized them up immediately as gamblers. Another reason Sheriff Harrington had always met the train, for a good lawman made it his business to be aware of newcomers and their purpose for being in town. On the frontier, many a man's purpose for being in town was his having been run out of the last one. At a distance, Nathan followed, watching the new arrivals head for the Long Branch Saloon. It was the most popular of all the saloons in Dodge, and generally the less troublesome, insofar as gamblers were concerned. Empty had quickly developed a dislike for the saloons, and like Cotton Blossom, remained outside when Nathan entered one. Some saloon gambling went beyond poker and faro, with cockfights, dogfights, bare-knuckle boxing, and knife fights. The many times Nathan had been in Dodge, he had avoided these sporting saloons because he disliked the cruelty. Now, wearing a badge, he felt he ought to know what was going on there. Some saloons featuring bloody entertainment had lower or cellar rooms for that purpose. One such saloon was the Saratoga, and it was near 10 o'clock when Nathan arrived. A few men loitered around the bar, and there was a poker game in progress, but most of the commotion came from below.
What's going on down there?
Dogfight.
Nathan descended the stairs, and nobody even noticed him. Every eye was on the circular pit in which a pair of bleeding dogs stalked each other. As Nathan's eyes grew accustomed to the poor light, he could see that only one of the animals was a dog. The other was a prairie wolf, or nearly so, and the odds clearly favored the wolf. It was gaunt, had likely been starved for the event, and there was more at stake than who won or lost the deadly match. The dog, when it could no longer defend itself, would be ripped to shreds and eaten.
This has gone far enough. I want the owners of those animals to separate them.
Don't be a damn fool. That wolf will tear a man apart. He'll be shot when this is done.
It's done now.
But Nathan had his back to the wall and had not holstered his Colt. The hapless dog was mortally wounded and would soon bleed to death. Nathan fired again, putting the dog out of its misery.
I'm to look in on you gents every night. There'll be no more of this foolishness while I'm wearing the badge and dodge.
You won't be wearing it much longer.
Nathan backed up the stairs, his Colt steady in his hand. Somebody seized him from behind, and he flung the man over his head into those who followed him up the stairs. He turned, barely in time to meet the barkeep coming from the bar with a sawed-off shotgun.
Don't!
Nathan backed the barkeep away from the top of the stairs. Slowly, the man lowered the weapon, placing it on the bar. The poker game had broken up, and Nathan worked his way toward the door, his back to the wall. Reaching the door, he paused long enough to issue a warning to the bartender.
As long as I wear this badge, there'll be no more fights to the death. If it happens again, somebody's going to the Calabozo. You, maybe.
It ain't again the law.
It is now. Spread the word.
The word was spread, and more rapidly than Nathan had expected. Foster Hagerman again joined him at breakfast, and his mood was somewhere between embarrassment and aggravation.
The town council's meeting tonight, and they want you there.
I'll be there. It wouldn't have anything to do with what I said and did at the Saratoga last night, would it?
It would. Damn it, you're enforcing laws that don't even exist.
Well, they should. Hagerman, I've killed men that were needful of it, and I will again, but I won't see one animal pitted against another to the death. I didn't want this damn badge, but you insisted. Now, you tell Rufus Langley and his gutless council I'll meet with them for just as long as it takes to drop this badge in their laps.
Nobody's going to ask for your badge, Nathan.
While the day seemed to drag on forever, there were some gratifying moments. Every woman Nathan met smiled at him, and he believed that was a result of the stand he had taken the night before in the Saratoga Saloon. One thing bothered him. He felt guilty, as though he had cast Sheriff Harrington in a bad light. Hadn't Harrington been confronted with the same cruel fights to the death that Nathan had witnessed? Was that what it took to become a successful lawman, overlooking popular but shameful activities that violated one's sense of right and wrong? With some misgivings, he left the Dodge House a few minutes before 7 o'clock, bound for the town hall. He had no idea how many members were on the town council, and he was surprised to find there were 10, including Foster Hagerman. Most of them, like Rufus Langley, were merchants, and they only nodded. Hagerman stood up and addressed the group.
On behalf of the council, you are to be commended for your action last night. In all due respect to the late Sheriff Harrington, we failed to stand behind him with laws that he could enforce. We're typical of most towns on the frontier yielding to the saloons, allowing them to dictate to the rest of us.
You're all commending me for enforcing laws that don't exist because none of you have to face up to the responsibility. You never gave Sheriff Harrington a legal leg to stand on because you were, and still are, intimidated by the saloon owners. I'm in a position where if I continue what I started last night, every damn saloon owner in town has a perfect right to hate my guts. These fights to the death should be illegal. Are you going to side me or not?
I am. I'm making a motion that saloon fights of all kinds be outlawed. Do I hear a second?
9 men hung their heads.
Wait, why? Damn it, when you have a sheriff willing to enforce the law, you won't let him do it. Why?
I'll tell you. We all got wives, Foster. And they see what happened last night as the start of a movement that'll eventually close the saloons on Sunday and the whorehouse is permanent. We can't do a little without doing it all. And that'll be the death of us. Come spring, when the herds come up the trail from Texas, do you want the saloons dark on Sundays and the whorehouses shut for good? If that happens, it's purely gonna ruin business.
Hagerman looked helplessly at Nathan.
I've nothing against saloons being open all night and all day, every day. If a man wants to drink, that's his business. I favor whorehouses because there's a need for them. The men and women who make them possible are there by their own choosing. But damn it, when two animals are trapped in a pit, being forced to fight for their lives, they have no choice. I can't reform the world, but I aim to stand up for the dumb brutes that can't speak for themselves. Those of you whose women have you haltered and muzzled, I hope you can bust loose long enough to tell them where I stand. I'm my own man, and if I have to enforce the law according to my conscience, then I'll do it.
Well, unless somebody has more to say on the subject, I'm declaring this meeting adjourned.
Nobody said anything, and Nathan didn't linger. He returned to the Dodge House with Empty trotting along beside him. The saloons wouldn't begin to roar for another 2 hours, and he intended to rest while he could.
Identify yourself.
Hagerman. You see how it is.
Yes, but you didn't come here to say that.
No, I came here to tell you that what you said was exactly right. I don't agree with the position they're taking, but I understand it. It all comes back to the old adage that when you give somebody an inch, he'll take a mile. I never saw it coming to all this when I asked you to take the badge, and if you give it up, there will be no hard feelings on my part.
I reckon I'll just ride this bronc for a while. I aim to see that Dodge gets more law than it's accustomed to. When I'm gone and it falls back into its old hell-raising habits, your town council will be roasted over a slow fire.
Oh, well, then you don't aim to close the saloons on Sunday and board up the whorehouses.
Not until the town council makes them illegal. As a lawman, I'll try and keep men from killing one another without cause, abusing women, or torturing animals. I reckon the wives of the town council will be disappointed. But it's unlikely they'll ever find a man who can enforce the Ten Commandments for $50 a month.
The moment Kurt Graves stepped off the westbound, Nathan suspected trouble. On his right hip, the newcomer carried a thong-down colt, and slung over his shoulder was a saddlebag. He was dressed entirely in black, including his hat. A black leather vest was studded with silver conchas. His belt buckle was a silver wagon wheel. His eyes paused on Nathan's twin colts, worked their way up to his sheriff's badge, and finally focused on his face. Nathan's eyes never faltered as he went to meet the stranger.
You have business here, I reckon?
I do. My own. None of yours.
I make it mine when an hombre looks a mite gun handy.
You got a gun ordinance here?
No. I depend on a man's common sense as far as he'll let me. If you pull that iron, you better have a damn good reason or I'll take it away from you.
I'm Kurt Graves, and I'm not wanted by the law. Nobody's ever took my gun and nobody ever will. You best keep that in mind.
Nathan watched Graves out of sight. He looked maybe 21 or 2, and he didn't seem the brawling kind. More likely, he relied on his gun, and Nathan wondered how long it would take this rooster to get himself involved in a shootout. Nathan generally made the rounds of all the saloons before 10 o'clock every night, and again shortly before 2 in the morning when most of them closed. Reaching the Oasis, he wasn't surprised to find Kurt Graves involved in a poker game. There was some grumbling when Graves won 2 pots. Nathan wasn't sure that Graves wasn't slick dealing, but if he was, the little varmint was good at it. Unless somebody called him, it was none of Nathan's business. Nathan headed to the door, bound for the Long Branch. Nathan turned. A man was slumped over the poker table, a gun in his hand. Graves stood with his back to the wall, his thumb hooked in his gun belt above the butt of his Colt. Nathan kept his eyes on Graves.
Who drew first?
Tidwell did. But my God, he didn't have a chance. He had his gun out, but he was shot dead.
Graves, I warned you about pulling that gun.
You'd better have a damn good reason.
Oh, I do, sir. He called me a cheat, and I never touched my gun until he drew his.
Is he telling the truth?
Yeah.
Do any of the rest of you accuse him of cheating?
Several men cut their eyes at Kurt Graves, but since nobody spoke to Nathan, there was nothing he could do.
Well then, I suppose there's nothing for it but to declare it a case of self-defense. Some of you men see to his remains.
When Nathan arrived at Delmonico's for breakfast, he found Foster Hagerman already there. It had become a ritual, Nathan and Sheriff Harrington meeting there. But now that Harrington was gone, Hagerman seemed to have taken his place.
I heard about the shooting last night. That sort of thing, if it should happen too often, will play hell with the town's image.
Is that how you feel, or is it the opinion of your silent town council?
Mostly that of the council. This is the frontier, and you can't fault a man for defending himself. But there are men who enjoy killing, and they justify it by provoking others into a shootout. Kurt Graves may be that kind.
He may be, but I can't arrest him as long as it's an even break and there are witnesses. You don't enforce the law by violating it. What does the council think should be done?
Hell, they don't know. They're leaving it all up to you.
Yeah, tell them I'm obliged.
Hagerman had unknowingly touched on the very thing Nathan had been considering. Suppose Kurt Graves continued to antagonize men and gun them down in the name of self-defense. Where would it end? While he was tempted to just order Graves out of town, he had no legal right to do so. Besides, if the gunman refused to leave, it would result in a Mexican standoff, branding Nathan Stone the biggest damn fool between the Trinity and the Yellowstone. There was always a chance that Graves wouldn't repeat his performance of the night before, and with that slight hope, Nathan made his way to the sheriff's office. But that very afternoon, at the Vanity's Saloon, Kurt Graves gunned down another man. Again, there were witnesses, and again, the claim was self-defense.
That man's a killer. He's legally murdered two men. What are we going to do?
You're going to shut up before you get the town in an uproar. I aim to make my move tonight. If it fails, plant me alongside Sheriff Harrington and feed my dog.
Kurt Graves seemed to be making the rounds of all the saloons. His third night in Dodge, he drifted into the Long Branch. A four-handed poker game was in progress, and at the sight of Graves, two men folded and moved hurriedly away from the table. The pair remaining were drummers.
I'm setting in.
Hell, I don't like three-handed poker.
Keep your seat. I'm buying in.
I don't play poker with law dogs. Pin a badge on some blotto and he thinks he's got an edge.
Don't let the badge bother you, Grace.
Removing the star, he dropped it into his shirt pocket.
Now, you either play poker or tuck your tail between your legs and get the hell out of here.
Sensing a showdown, men lined the walls, careful to stay out of the potential line of fire. It was a ticklish situation for Kurt Graves, and there were beads of sweat on his forehead. Finally, he did exactly what Nathan had expected him to do. Keeping his right hand well away from his Colt, he shoved his left hand into his pocket and brought out a handful of double eagles.
$5 bet, table stakes.
Nathan dropped a double eagle on the table, and each of the drummers matched it. The first three hands, Nathan drew impossible cards. He took his losses, and when it came his turn to shuffle the deck, he slick dealt Graves an unbeatable hand, four aces and a king. It took a moment for Graves to understand what had happened, and his face paled, but his money was already in the pot. There were gasps from the onlookers when they saw the cards. It was the perfect setup for Nathan to accuse Graves of cheating. Graves had begun sweating, but all he could do was rake in the pot. He started to get up.
It's customary to allow the losers a chance to recoup their losses.
There were hostile faces all around Graves, and across the table, Nathan Stone's cold blue eyes never wavered. Graves hunched his chair back up to the table, and play resumed. It seemed Kurt Graves couldn't lose, even without Nathan's help, and he took the next two pots. After he won a third pot, he had trouble controlling the trembling of his hands. But Nathan decided it had gone far enough. He spoke softly, but it had the effect of an explosion.
Graves, You've been cheating, but your luck just ran out. Draw.
No! You've been setting me up!
You're a liar, a cheat, and a coward. Draw, damn you.
No!
When the train pulls out of here tomorrow, you'd better be on it.
Graves had drawn. Nathan turned and drew, barely in time. Graves' slug ripped into the tabletop as lead from Nathan's Colt slammed into his chest. Graves fell into his chair and it tipped over backward. Nathan reloaded his Colt and returned his badge to its position on his shirt.
I'm claiming self-defense. Does anybody dispute that?
My God, no. That little sidewinder come within a whisker drilling you in the back.
A couple of you, haul him out of here to the Undertaker.